Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Few families in America have impacted the food scene quite like the Brennans of New Orleans. The Brennans' legacy began with Owen Brennan in 1946 when he opened his original restaurant, the Vieux Carré. By the early 1950s, Owen decided to move his restaurant from Bourbon Street to its present location on Royal, changing the name to Brennan's Restaurant. Working at Owen's side from the earliest days was his little sister, Ella Brennan. When Owen unexpectedly passed away before the new restaurant opened on Royal, it fell to the family to soldier on and see Owen's dream to completion. The rest is history. A history recently chronicled in the frank new memoir, Miss Ella of Commander's Palace. On this week's show, the whole Brennan clan weighs in as we celebrate the amazing legacy of Ella Brennan and the iconic restaurant she calls home, Commander's Palace. So, Miss Ella, this week's Louisiana Eats is all for you.
I'm T. Adelaide Martin of Commander's Palace and Cafe Adelaide and the Swizzle Stick Bar and Sobu.
Born into her family's restaurant dynasty as daughter of matriarch Ella Brennan, T. Martin knows all too well her mother's revered place both in the food industry and in New Orleans history. Miss Ella's life in hospitality is filled with remarkable stories of hardships and triumphs, all set against the backdrop of a city known for embracing life's sensory pleasures. Many of these tales have been chronicled in the pages of the Times-Picayune, while others have become the stuff of legend. Aware of the fascination with her mother's life story, T. Martin wrote a number of stories about Ella over the years and made a point to hang on to them.
You know, my whole life, honestly, people have said to my mom and I, because people know I like to write a little bit, that we should do a book. And we're like, we did a bunch of books. And we really put a lot into those cookbooks. I mean, going back to when she did the Brennan's cookbooks and the Commander's Kitchen and the first Commander's cookbook and the cocktail book. But that's not what people meant. They wanted to know how Ella became Ella. But there was one big problem. I could not convince Ella. She was uninterested in participating in this. And every time I asked her, just rolled her eyes and scrunched her mouth like a little kid. My mom is from the era of depression. She is of that generation that doesn't want to talk about themselves because it's about the common good and what's best for everyone. However, came a time when I said, you know, Mom, the beloved grandchildren and, you know, all my cousins, they don't really know how any of this came to be. And so in a weak moment, I convinced her.
So this is a collaboration between you and your mom. How did the book get written?
So it's sort of a lifelong conversation, really, between she and I. I had written many things about her over the years, and I had written in her voice. You know, and I had a binder of, you know, this is what she thinks about hospitality. This is about these type of subjects or these years or times with Jamie or. And so we just organized it and then we started filling in. And then when that was about to drive me insane and her insane, we did pull in a friend, Jerry Shriver, to help organize all of that and have some interviews. And as this book was coming to be, Leslie Iwerks wanted to do a documentary. So we were able to have Jerry Shriver, who helped on the book, and I and Leslie all in those same interviews. And that really helped us not wear the 90-year-old out and get all the information that we needed to pull it all together. So that kind of worked. We were lucky in that way.
Well, I really loved reading that from early days, your mom made it plain to you that the restaurant was not your playground.
Right. It's true. I mean, you would go in there with your little school project, you know, and you'd be Xeroxing things, and she would look up, and the manager of the restaurant would be there, and she'd be like, you know, gee, does the manager know you're using all that paper for your school project? You know, just letting me know. He's in charge, not you, you know. And the great respect, in fact, it's a term that we use in the restaurant that's hers, that she sits down with people when she first meets them, whenever she can, and says, you know, I'm going to come to work every day. And I want to try to earn your trust and respect. You could be the brand new cook, the brand new dishwasher, the brand new waiter. It doesn't matter. I'm going to try to earn your trust and respect. You don't owe it to me. And you're going to try to earn mine. And let's see how that works. And that's really how so many of those wonderful relationships started. And as certainly I get to it in the book in places, Mom can give the greatest speeches in the world. Very short, very impactful, or long and impactful. Anyway, she's just... ain't no coach got anything on her. I mean, she can make you believe things you never believed you could do. And that is a beautiful gift to people. And she gave that gift day in and day out.
There's so many good life lessons to be learned from Ella and from this book. You really didn't leave anything untouched. Your mom was frank about her divorce from your dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think you get to a place where you're comfortable talking about it. I think, you know, she still took the high road. She just was honest, you know. Dad was a, you know, bad alcoholic, and it was tough, you know. So she just put that out there for people to understand that that's what that was. But it wasn't in an ugly way. He was also an exceptional guy in a lot of ways.
But... she made that very clear. Mm-hmm. She did make mm-hmm. that very clear, too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's really hard stuff mm-hmm. to write about.
It's so funny that you say that because I was put off in doing this for many years by just these type of things. And because, you know, my mom has always taken the high road. And, you know, there's ways you can do things and other ways you can do things. And one of our favorite autobiographies we ever read was Kay Graham. So of the Washington Post, the famous Katharine Graham. And so I looked at that as sort of, okay, she kind of put it out there, but still took the high road. So that was a bit of a inspiration.
The chapter about leaving Brennan's for mm-hmm. the last time, you know, all of that has been covered in the press so much. And yet nobody's really ever told mm-hmm. the story mm-hmm. until your mom did. Mm-hmm. She took the high road and it was really mm-hmm. beautiful the way she expressed it.
Right. She refused to speak about it ever because there was nothing, you know, if you don't have anything nice to say, then don't tell, you know, I mean, just... leave it be kind of was the idea. If you look back at the first Commander's Cookbook that she did with Uncle Dick, I think it gets a half a sentence. And so she told a little fuller of a story here, and I think she's comfortable with that. And, I mean, it's no different than what happens in many businesses all over the world.
Of course not.
But I think it was a bit of a mystery to a lot of New Orleans because she had refused to speak about it. But you know, my favorite thing about that now is your darling, my darling, Tim Traplin, draws that drawing of the five of them walking out that door arm in arm. So that was pretty special that he read the chapter and understood and drew that.
Ella's memoir is illustrated with line drawings by New Orleans artist Tim Traplin that illustrate the story told in each chapter. Tim's work has long graced menus as well as walls within Brennan family restaurants, and he also illustrated T. and Lolly's book, In the Land of Cocktails. In addition to being collaborator and friend of the Brennan family, Tim Traplin also happens to be my cousin. I asked Cousin Tim about his involvement with the project and what it was like to depict some of Ella's most harrowing moments using pen and ink.
I think that the Brennans and Ella particularly, they are remarkable people. They come across to me as real New Orleans, but this also is really an honest, true, frank story, full of what every life is full, joys and sorrows, and they are working people. The sense of family, the sense of work, They continually told me there's always a Brennan on board, meaning there's always a Brennan in their restaurant working. As glamorous as their lives seem to be to outsiders, it's hard work. So, T, painted pictures with words. She would tell me each chapter, and then I'd read the chapter, of course, as I illustrated, but she would give me in words her painting of what she felt. And so it's really a combination. The illustrations are my hand, but it's T's insight. She painted the picture inside of my heart. And some of the illustrations had to do with parts of Ella's life that were very sad, you know, the death of her brother.
How in the world do you do a little drawing to illustrate the death of Owen?
And that was
How'd you do that?
Well, T was telling me about, first of all, it was the front of the Times-Picayune, but her dear mother was working, and they called her and said, you know, your brother has died. And she jumped in a cab with a police escort to go down Canal Boulevard to where they lived, to be there. You know, for them, again, family is first.
I loved the way you included the front page.
The newspaper, the Times-Picayune. Yeah, that was really. And T actually had pictures of that to show me. So it's a faithful interpretation of the real cover of the Times-Picayune. But there was some very frank parts of the book when, you know, the family went into its own different directions at that point. And how do I do that in an illustration and do it with sensitivity and kindness for everybody? And so T again described it to me, and I interpreted it the way I did in the drawing. So you see them from the back leaving the front door. That was a very, you know, that's a challenge to be able to convey that without anything negative. The generosity of Ella and their sense of work, family, that they are egalitarian, that's what I like about them. And this book brings that out.
You know, so many books in our world are just about food. And Mom was always about the whole of the restaurant business, particularly the hospitality part, but also the leadership and the, you know, and the service and the business part of it. So to me, I was speaking to the hospitality industry, to New Orleans, and a little bit just personally for Mom and I to young women. And when you think a little about the documentary, you know, so often they're tragic, you know, but this isn't tragic. There was certainly tragedies, a lot of them along the way, but this is a triumphant story. This is the great American story.
Do you have any message that is your big overriding message that you want people to take away from the fabulous Miss Ella of Commander's Palace?
You know, she says that if you really get to love what you do because of that striving to be the best and helping the whole community around you, you know, of your people, your family, your vendors, the whole community of the industry you're in, then it's not work. And they really made it a lifestyle and not a working career. So it all meshed together. And my life's like that today. So she always says if you have to work for a living, it is a beautiful way to do it.
That was T. Martin and Tim Traplin discussing the newly published memoir, Miss Ella of Commander's Palace. To get a better understanding of Ella Brennan's impact on New Orleans and the restaurant world, let's listen as the Brennan's family tell the story in their own words. We begin with Ella's journey from teenager to becoming the force of nature behind Brennan's on Royal Street.
You know, I think some of it was certainly circumstances. You know, the men kind of were all off at war, and her brother had decided to do this bar, and she had gotten out of high school, and someone sent her to secretarial school, which lasted about 10 minutes. You know, that was not going to fly with Ella Jean Brennan. So a little bit circumstances, and, you know, as she always says, I don't remember having a choice in that. You know, they didn't have much. I mean, they had to move forward. They had a big family, and they're trying to find a way to support that big family.
Ella Brennan, tell me about your brother, and how did he rope you into the restaurant business?
Well, it's amazing. You know, he died in 1955, and I could remember him as if he was standing right there and hearing him talk. He wanted the family to be in a business so we could take care of our mother and father in their late years. He was 15 years older than I was. And I spent the years from high school working with him because he was always interested in making sure I learned how to do something. And all of a sudden, one day he bought a restaurant. And that's where I was. When we first started, it was just basically my daddy and me. And then Adelaide and John came, and Dick was young. So by the time he finished school, went in the military, and came home, there we were. I guess my earliest memories was realizing how much I didn't know. It took me a little while to get that message. My brother got that in my head pretty quick, that, look, you don't know anything, just learn, learn, learn.
And then she's just driven. So once she started, she got on a mission. And then was very much self-taught, but there were so many people who took her under their wing, which I can imagine it would have been easy to do because she's just lovable and intellectually curious, permanently intellectually curious.
We happened to have, in this restaurant when we went to work there, two fabulous men. One was named Jack Ames, and the other one was Paul Blanger. And they taught me. They taught me everything. They taught me pork from lamb, you know? I mean, my mother was a fabulous cook, but I didn't cook at home at all. They were like surgeons, the beautiful knowledge they had with their hands, how to cut a fish, tenderloin the fish, portion the fish. When it got to meat, I remember Paul would take the piece of meat and he'd say, okay, this costs this much, so we got to get this many portions out of this meat. Now this is how we're gonna do it. And I literally sat there like I was an intern in a hospital watching these guys, and I was fascinated because I had never seen this before. Bananas Foster, we put this dish together, and I'll give Paul all the credit. My brother Owen had been appointed by Chet Morrison to be vice chairman of vice committee. They were supposed to clean up the French Quarter. Dick Foster was the chairman. So Owen said to me, I want to have a special dessert and I want to name it after Dick. And he said, go figure something out. So we talked, and what can we do? What can we do? And finally, my father mentioned bananas being there and available all the time. Then I started talking about how much I love my mother's version of, she had many versions, but particularly one I remember is she would just saute the bananas in brown sugar. So somehow or other, we put the dish together, and they decided to flame it with banana liqueur and rum, and we served it over ice cream. And my brother Owen said to me later that day, why did you put the ice cream on it? And I said, I say to this day, ice cream did pretty good, you know? My brother said, well, look, you've got to get out of here and learn what's going on in the world. So the next thing you know, I'm in New York, I'm in London, in Paris. People were so kind to me. They just took me under their wing and off we went.
She constantly was learning from the best. She knew how to go to people like James Beard and the people at 21 and just learned everything she could from them.
So. And Lucian Beebe.
Oh, Lucius Beebe. I mean, he really, in a great way, was a big part of the creation of Breakfast at Brennan's.
Mr. Beebe, he's the man who knows. Mr. Beebe sets the style in clothes.
Lucius Beebe was a frequent visitor to New Orleans, and he frequently stayed at the apartment above the Absin House. And this is a very elegant, bon vivant type, smashing guy. Owen had said, we've got to do something to get this restaurant known and people coming here. And Lucius started talking about, well, he was getting older and he much preferred having a great meal in the middle of the day rather than late at night. And no one came up with breakfast at Brennan's. Of course, they said, Ella, do a menu. They hadn't had any volunteers around, you know, so I got stuck. I'm the young, when you're the youngest, and my sister Dottie can tell you that, you get all the jobs.
Mr. Beebe, thank you for the tip. Mr. Beebe, you made all of heaven.
Before the invention of Bananas Foster, what was the most famous flaming dessert in America? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blend beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold.
When you mind, you will soon find out.
Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. Before the invention of Bananas Foster, what was the most famous flaming dessert in America? Cherry's Jubilee. To give you an idea of the significance of that from a culinary history point of view, Cherry's Jubilee was created in 1897 by the great French chef Escoffier in honor of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. Cherry's Jubilee maintained that status until Owen Brennan tasked his chef, Paul Blanger, and his little sister, Ella Brennan, to come up with a flaming dessert featuring the South American bananas that poured through the port of New Orleans in the mid-20th century. Today, Bananas Foster is famous world over and still remains one of the favorite desserts served at any Brennan restaurant. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Bananas Foster makes for some great Louisiana eats.
I'll make the best. Cherry, I'll get you.
The story of Ella Brennan and the Brennan family continues with the second generation recollecting scenes from their childhood at Brennan's on Royal Street.
Well, I'm Ralph Brennan. I'm the co-proprietor of Brennan's restaurant. What often happened when I was very young is that I was the right age for my aunts Ella and Adelaide to take me on weekends. The tradition was to have go to a movie, and then they actually would take me to Woolworths. Now I'm about 7 or 8 years old when this is all happening, and they'd buy me a toy or something to play with because we came back over to the restaurant at 4 o'clock, and they would go to work, and then I would play. And so my memories of this building at that age were a playground. I had the free run from all the way in the attic in the third floor, all the way downstairs to the kitchen, out to the wine cellar in the back. And I used to run around and play here and, you know, interact with the staff and try not to get in any trouble.
My name is T. Adelaide Martin.
And hi, I'm Lally Brennan.
Well, I mean, I remember so much of it. Yeah. I mean, I remember Chopsteak Stanley. Yeah. I remember great big broiled tomatoes stuffed with spinach. Mm-hmm. I remember
baked apples.
Baked apples all the time. And then the broiled grapefruit with the brown sugar on it.
Although I loved Bananas Foster, my favorite was Crepes Fitzgerald. Mm-hmm. The strawberries. I've always loved strawberries. So that was the perfect dessert for me. And as I was growing up too, I found a refrigerator where it was all stored, and I'd often just eat it cold.
I remember eating my first escargot with Aunt Adelaide. I took one bite and it went from one side of my mouth to the other side of the mouth, and then I swallowed.
Dickie, do you have any childhood memories of eating at the Brennan's on Royal Street?
Oh, absolutely. You know, my dad worked Sundays, and as I got older, I'd go down with him, and I'd go play out in the patio because they had the fountain that the water ran down this gutter, I guess, right in the courtyard and went all the way to where the front door would be, and we would float the little wooden stir sticks. Then he'd sit me at a table, and I'd get an egg dish sent to me, and I have vivid memories of being with my dad for breakfast. Our family had built a business on Royal Street through the 50s and 60s. In the 70s, our family split up the business. And so my dad, Aunt Ella, my Uncle John, and my Aunt Adelaide and Aunt Dottie moved from their flagship, which was, you know, something they built into being a very successful business, into Commander's, which had become very run down over the years and didn't know if they were going to be able to pay the light bills. So I certainly was exposed to them having a lot of stress and trying to figure out what they were going to do to turn this old gym back into something, you know, that could thrive.
Well, Owen always said, you want a restaurant that New Orleanians will be proud of. They will want to celebrate there and they will entertain their guests there. You want a restaurant that is more than just the neighborhood restaurant. So when we got to Commander's, we knew what we had to do. Of course, up to that point, we didn't have everybody running the kitchen. These guys were running it, and I wasn't very happy with it, neither was anybody else. I have to tell you this wonderful story, because it's very true. We made up our mind we were going to go to work at Commander's the day after Mardi Gras. And on that weekend before that, all of a sudden, my sister Dottie is in the hospital having a mastectomy out of the clear blue sky. So I'm in at the hospital visiting with her, and this friend brings me the newspaper. And I read the newspaper, and the critic of the paper, it was called the Underground Gourmet.
Yes, yes.
There was a black dot instead of any stars or anything.
Oh,
else.
No.
And I said, well, the crazy thing about it is, right, it's a terrible restaurant. I really meant that. I spoke to him about it. I told him, I said, look, I read your column. I think it's disastrous. I think it's the worst thing that happened to a restaurant. But maybe basically it's true. And I just want to tell you, just watch. What are we going to do after we'd gotten that black ball? We said, okay, we're going to run the best restaurant we know how. And everybody's going to do what they know how to do. So everybody started falling into what their natural talents were. Dick and I spent a lot of time talking about food, talking about menus and cooks.
I've always heard Maya and Ella talk about New Orleans and how every New Orleanian is a great cook. And when Aunt Ella and the family were moving up to Commander's, they were looking for a chef. And that's when they came upon Paul Prudhoe.
From Terry Fletridge.
He's from, oh, mm-hmm. Good story. Mm-hmm.
Terry and I were having lunch because she was leaving town. And she said, how's it going? I said, awful. I need to find a chef, somebody that can really run that kitchen. Terry said, I'm going on the phone, I'm going to call somebody. She went to the phone, she called Paul Prudhoe. Mm-hmm. And Paul came up the next day and stayed. I mean, he was there for, you know, 8 years or something.
Yes.
He just sort of went in the kitchen. And we'd sit down every day and talk. Well, what do you think? What are you thinking? What are you going to do today? What are you going to do tomorrow? What should we be doing? And what season is it? We knew that a lot of the things that were going on with people, we didn't exactly like what was happening. And so we said, we're going to just go down and do real New Orleans food.
I know most of what is in her head, you know, and that she was just always pushing, always wanting to evolve. I mean, if it ain't broke, don't fix it is not what she believes. She said, if it ain't broke, fix it anyway. And I have to say, I think it was Alice Waters with Jeremiah Tower. originally kind of showing us, you know, that indigenous cuisine thing. And we were just always looking, particularly my mom, I have to say.
My name's Tori McPhail, and I'm the executive chef of Commander's Palace. All the folks that have been born and raised here, they've always kind of known how special Louisiana food is. It's the only indigenous food to all of North America. You know, I think Paul really started putting Louisiana food on the map.
Paul, coming from the bayou, was doing his version of what they were doing down in the Cajun country. And we started melding them together. And I kept saying, Paul, it's got to be a little bit lighter. It's got to be a little bit lighter. It's got to be a little bit lighter. Cajun food's a lot heavier.
And to have Paul come in as a big Cajun and start to crashing together Cajun and Creole, I mean, before 1969, that was kind of unheard of until the Bon Ton Cafe. And the Commanders right after that, hiring Big Paul, it really stirred things up. People really started to take notice and say, man, what is Ella doing? What is going on that they have a Cajun chef in Uptown? It was unheard of. And Cajun food, you know, sometimes didn't have the best reputation to all the blue bloods and all the more wealthy folks in New Orleans. So Paul really said, hey, man, this is our food. This is our culture. It doesn't matter what part of the state you're necessarily from. This is how we do it. And let me introduce you to my flavors.
But basically, he's one of the most natural cooks you'll ever find. It's in him.
I remember being in college, and she called me at college and said, you know, look on Johnny Carson tonight, Paul Prudhomme's going to be on. I'm like, what's up with that? And she, I said, that's great. She said, well, they asked me and I didn't want to do it. I want America to understand what chefs are about. And of course, Paul looks the part, walks the part, and talks the part, and can cook the part, and everything wonderful. So, you know, she pushed him out there.
Since then, you know, Rolling Stone magazine and taking the show on the road to L.A., Chicago, having his own spice line, he really said, hey, this is New Orleans. Let me introduce you to that.
You know, I talk about magic in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
They either have it or they don't. And what do I mean by that? It's what they're going to put in. I mean, it's the seasoning. It's the selection of the dish to begin with, the raw material, what are they going to serve. And if they have this magic in their hands, they can take this wonderful dish and wow.
Paul Prudhomme told me one time, he says, did I ever tell you what your dad did to me with bread pudding souffle? And I'm like, no. He said, man, it was a busy, busy dinner at Commander's. And he says, I was working the line and we were just really going down. And your dad walks all the way on the line with me and comes up, whispers in my ear. He says, Paul, let's make a great dessert. Let's do a bread pudding souffle. And he said, first he's like, geez, Dick, I'm trying to get us out of the weeds here. Can we talk later? And he's like, well, sure. But he said he couldn't stop thinking about it. And in fact, as soon as the shift was over, he went home and kind of just wrote out kind of a recipe for it. And it was just real simple. It just came to him right away. He went in the restaurant first thing the next morning, pulled one together, let him try it, and it was history. He also walked into Paul one day. He says, Paul, I walk to work every day, and I step on pecans. He says, but I've never stepped or seen an almond tree in New Orleans. Why do we do trout almondine when we could be doing trout pecan? And that's when we created at Commander's Trout Pecan. What amazes me is trout almondine has been on our menu for hundreds of years. Why pecans weren't used when they're our local, you know, we were a port city, so we had products that came in, but wow, that one was long overdue.
You have any special memories of your time in the kitchen with Paul?
Oh, yeah, he was great. And he'd come up to me and he'd motivate me. He'd say, you know, everybody's watching everything you do. You know, you got to do it as good or better than everybody. And I go, yes, sir. But he supported me. He wanted me to be successful. What a hell of a guy. And boy, how fortunate am I, you know, to have people like that as a mentor.
Absolutely.
Would you tell us the story of the birth of the New Orleans Jazz Brunch? How did your dad get this idea?
I guess it was like 73 or 4, no, it's probably 74, 75. We had gone to Europe, and it was while we were there. He saw some musicians. I guess it came to him, I want to put music in the dining room. It's New Orleans. It's jazz. Let's put music and food together in the dining room. And then he told Aunt Ella on the phone, he says, I've got a great idea. I want to do jazz brunch at Commander's. And she's like, sure, whatever. Come on home. Quit playing. Come on home. And so Dad called up Alvin Acorn, who was a great jazz musician locally, and said, Alvin, can you come by with a couple of people? I want you to just play some nice jazz music in the dining room. I don't want a stage. I don't want you, stand. I want you to walk around the dining room. So here we were, and it was the Saturday before the first Sunday, and someone had done an etching of the facade of Commander's, so it had that unique with the sign that hangs out over Washington Avenue. And so it was that picture, and it said, take the streetcar to the historic Garden District, Jazz Brunch, Commander's Palace. And literally ran off copies up in the office there. And my sister and I got on a streetcar and went down to the French Quarter. And we walked around Jackson Square, believe it or not. And we passed out these pamphlets all Saturday. And we wake up Sunday morning. My dad wakes me up, and I'm putting on my busboy outfit. I had the black pants and the white shirt and the bow tie and polished shoes. Always had to have polished shoes. And we were walking to the restaurant, early morning to go set it up. And he asked me, he said, how many people you think we're going to do? I was like, I don't know. I mean, I was a teenager. I was like, I don't know. And he kept pushing me. I said, I hired 100 people. And he's like, well, that would be good. All right. Well, at 200 people, we closed the doors. I guess we did a good job of passing out the pamphlets. But I can remember, we were little kids, and the people who would stop, and they'd say, well, what you got? And we'd describe it. They'd go, wow. And I mean, think about it. You're in the French Quarter. Yeah. You get to, it's a reason to take this incredible streetcar that's been around forever. You go into one of the most historic neighborhoods outside of the French Quarter in New Orleans, to a wonderful old neighborhood restaurant that had been there almost 100 years old, to go listen to music, jazz music, and have brunch.
It's a magical mixture.
That sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
It sounds fantastic.
It's an honor for me that I was able to witness or participate to the extent I did, and to see how it's become such a tradition in this city, and I've always looked up to my dad. He's got incredible vision, and, things that he's come up with have been amazing, but that's just kind of, that's him.
When we return from a short break, our chronological journey through the Brennan family history takes us to the present day. Stay tuned. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Ralph's on the Park, featuring Chef Chip Flanagan's globally influenced New Orleans cuisine overlooking City Park. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch and private events at 900 City Park Avenue in New Orleans, Mid-City. And now, we continue with the story of Ella Brennan and the iconic Commander's Palace.
After 5 years as executive chef at Commander's, Paul Prudhomme began his transition out in order to focus his energies on his new restaurant, K. Paul.
Paul wanted to leave, so he said, you got to find somebody. And I said, well, okay, so we went to work. And I really wanted a chef. I wanted somebody who could take that kitchen and really organize it better, even than Paul could do at that time. And so along came this recommendation for Emerald. And I told the man, no. He's too young, doesn't have the right experience. So the man said, I'm gonna bring him down. And I remember saying to the man, don't bring him down because I'm rejecting him now. Don't bring that young man down here and have me face to face have to reject this kid. Mm-hmm. He said, bring him down anyway. So he brought him down. And there we were.
So there's Paul, then there's Emeril Lagasse, then
Jamie Shannon.
There's Jamie Shannon.
Jamie grew up in our kitchen. He was a little boy from New Jersey, the seashore in New Jersey. And he went to CIA, and he asked the man, Tim Ryan, who's there today, he said to him he wanted to go learn about American cuisine. And Tim said, we'll start in New Orleans. Well, when Jamie got here, he was working in the kitchen. Emeril took him on. And so Jamie was there. And when Emeril got ready to leave, I'll never forget, we had four guys we could take as chef. Any one of them could have done the job. Emeril said, that's the one. That's the one.
He was amazing. And he just got to where he lived and breathed this whole thing about New Orleans food and Creole food. And really, all he did was go out and collect and read old Creole cookbooks. And it was a huge part of the beginning of the farmer's market. He lived and breathed it, and he was naughty in all the best ways. Because he was just like a big kid, other than when it came to work. I mean, he always, in fact, one of my favorite sayings with Jamie, you know, you go out and party and play with the big dogs, you get up and go to work with the big dogs. You never miss a shift, you're never late, you're ready to go. But good God, he could cook.
My name's Tori McPhail, and I'm the executive chef of Commander's Palace. For me as a kid, I mean, he was the guy you saw 5 and 6 days a week. Big guy, he was like 6'3", probably 225, literally larger than life. Then when he puts on the crisp chef's jacket and a long white apron and then puts another foot of chef's hat on top of that, the guy comes walking in and there is no question who the chef of that restaurant is, right? There wasn't a mistake on by a new server or a new cook. You know, you don't walk up and call a sous chef, hey, chef, how are you this morning? That just did not happen. It was Jamie Shannon, period, the end.
Still to this day, people will walk up to me and there'll be somebody I don't really remember and there will have been a pot washer or something. They'll say, Jamie took me by the, you know, as my mother would say, head of the hair and sent me out and talked to me and mentored me. And now I'm a cook and a sous chef and a chef and wherever. And I mean, he just was an amazing human being.
I love the guy for so many reasons, in the restaurant and out of the restaurant. He was just a great mentor and such a good, he's kind of like a player's coach, you know what I mean? Like somebody that everybody could look up to. Yeah, he was probably sick for maybe longer than any of us knew about, longer than he would tell anybody. You know, he started, you know, just kind of walking with a bit of a limp, and he's like, yeah, you know, I used to play hockey growing up in Jersey. And it was just kind of one of those things. It's like, yeah, my hip kind of hurts.
It was just heartbreaking because he and T were on an airplane. They were traveling somewhere together. And when he was walking, T says, Jamie, your walking is getting worse and worse.
We're walking down in an airport, and I just said to him, literally, I just like, dude, what's with the limp? You know, just, you know, buddies picking on each other. And he said, man, my leg's really been bothering me. I went to a chiropractor. I was like, oh, good Lord, would you please go to a doctor when we get home? And that's just the beginning of a long, bad story.
I finally got the whole thing checked out, and then ended up that he had cancer. I was in Las Vegas at the time, and it was tough. You know, when he calls you and says, hey, look, I got cancer. This is the deal. They amputated my leg. I mean, how can you not just like bawl crying on the telephone? I mean, that's your mentor. That's the guy. That's the guy you've always looked up to, is, you know, being 2,000 miles away from home, and that's family. You know what I mean? So to take that call and have that conversation and have him say, hey, man, come back to New Orleans, come back to the Commanders team. You know, I want you to be my eyes and ears and my legs so we can continue to push Commanders forward. I mean, that just, you know, goes right to your heart. It's a tough telephone call, tough day.
But he was just one of the talk about magic in his hands.
Life is just a bowl of cherries. Don't take it serious. Life's too mysterious.
It's the most inspiring thing. People don't work too much like you know how to work. And I know that you were at the restaurant, no matter which restaurant it was, 6 to 7 days a week, till you were 79 years old, you were there.
Yeah. It became a way of life. It was not work. It was just...
It was life.
What you do.
It was life.
Yeah.
So how can you lose what you never owned?
I realized what absolutely fantastic mentors I had. Absolutely fantastic. The cooks, and then there was my older brother and sister, Adelaide and Owen. She mentored him. He mentored me. I mean, it was all each teaching each other. And I finally began to realize that's what it was all about. So when, in addition to running the restaurant, you could build these people and this team. And when they all realized how much they could do together and help each other and make, we have a school. We've been teaching for years now. When they sit down, we tell them, we ask them where they want to go. And if they sound like they're interested in something and they have some ideas, we try to progress with that.
It's been my distinct honor to count the entire Brennan clan as friends for many years. Congratulations to them all for their many successes, but most of all, kudos to Miss Ella for having the spunk, the vision, as well as the determination to forever change America's food scene, and to bravely tell her amazing story in her memoir, Miss Ella of Commander's Palace, now available in bookstores everywhere. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we celebrate our one-year anniversary at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum with a walking tour of our neighborhood to meet the neighbors.
This pupusa, the golden one, is made with crawfish. We started doing that for Mardi Gras, and now we kept it on because everybody liked it so much.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, and with support from the Palace Cafe, home of crab meat cheesecake and white chocolate bread pudding, in the historic Worline Music Building on Canal Street. Join us on Thursday, September the 29th at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum when Louisiana Eats and French Market Coffee help celebrate Toujac Restaurant's historic 160th anniversary with the first in a series of wine-paired dinners to benefit the museum. To learn more, call Toujac's at 504-525-8676 or visit them online at toujacsrestaurant.com. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.